Hello and welcome to the Mixed Media Podcast. I'm Chris Bogner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News. I'm joined in the studio, as always, by Christopher C. Dub Wynn. He's the arts and culture editor for the Dallas Morning News. Hello, Christopher.
Hello, C. Bogner.
Also with us, as always, is the great Lauren Smart. She's the arts and culture editor for the Dallas Observer.
That is me.
You guys ready to talk about some music and stuff?
Yeah.
All right.
Let's do some jams.
Let's get started. On today's show, every song ever. We live in an era of musical plenty when almost anything you've ever wanted to hear is a mouse click away. Ben Ratliff's new book, Every Song Ever, is a genre-defying work of music appreciation for the age of excess availability. I think I am the person here who has read this book, but I think you guys are kind of familiar with it. We also have a couple of other big musical minds with us today. Hunter Hawk, the pop music critic, the Dallas Morning News, and Scott Cantrell, who I am enjoying calling the classical music critic emeritus.
Oh, it sounds so grand.
It does. It sounds very fancy.
He hasn't gone very far away, though.
Is there an academic hood that goes with
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's an
endowed chair, perhaps, as well. I found this book fascinating, Every Song Ever, and I'll just briefly state its premise. We now live at a time when you can listen to almost anything at any time you want, at any moment. So what are we listening for? What kinds of things cross genres from heavy metal to classical to jazz to blues, what have you? What are we listening for? What are we looking for? And it's Ben Ratliff is intimidatingly intelligent, and there are he has what the jazz musicians used to call big ears. He hears a lot in these songs, and I'm just kind of sitting there as I'm reading it, going, "Wow, you heard that? That's pretty amazing because I didn't hear that." He's a really good critic. He wrote a great book about John Coltrane a few years back as well, which I actually reviewed for the Dallas Morning News. So let's look at some examples of what's going on here, and then we can talk a little bit maybe about if these ideas hold up and what some other samples that we might have or these categories are. And there are some interesting categories. The first one we're going to look at is sadness in music.
Something I often look to music for to sadness to wallow.
To bring you down.
Something to wallow in.
This chapter was actually excerpted in the New York Times Sunday about 2 months ago, actually. So the Sunday Times, but not this last Sunday. And it's kind of about what kinds of music kind of hit those sad receptors in our brain. The chapter is called Blue Rules. And again, he's all over the place with some of this stuff. He talks about the blues. He talks also a lot about heavy metal, and so we are going to listen to a little bit of Slayer. This is Slayer's song, Disciple, an example of sadness in music.
That is not what my sadness
sounds like. Yeah, I don't know.
That is anger.
Right, yeah, that makes me enraged.
Yes, that's like go hurt something kind of music. So I'm actually, you guys can vamp through the book and try to find what he says about
The premise then is that like you're using music as an emotional like magnifying glass, sort of?
A reflection, a magnifying glass.
Release.
Sometimes the opposite.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you're sad, you want to just... It kind of goes hand in hand with rage and anger, and you want to just release it in some way.
There's that too.
So I mean, so this idea of every song ever, and then using this emotion, like is he trying to recategorize how we listen to music? Then
he's trying to give us some ways to think about the way we listen to music. He's not really looking to apply strict categorizations so much.
Well, certainly as far as classical music is concerned, and I imagine it's true of a lot of more popular idioms as well, there are certain kinds of harmonic languages that we associate with sadness, minor keys, obviously, chromatic writing, sort of descending chromatic scales. And I think, these across our culture would be recognized as sadness.
I knew there was a reason why.
I was just thinking.
Brought Scott here. Here's a little bit of
what he... when you put it that way, Scott.
Here's a little bit of what he has to say about heavy metal and sadness. Metal is the fanatical generation of myth. It holds the unthinkable in hysterical awe. It runs on fear, but looks like greed. It wants to pull the listener down into the earth, which is, of course, what will happen to the listener eventually.
Oh, my.
Wow.
So he's getting all existential.
Let's not get started too early.
Right.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, maybe I should have left sadness for last. Maybe that would have been better. Hunter, what do you think of when you think about sadness and music?
Probably every artist who's ever played like the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville. I mean, or Poor David's Pub here in town. I mean, I think of folk artists and
country, certainly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. People who want to cry in a song, and tell their story and compete for the saddest story ever.
So there's
with their lyrics.
There's a tear in my beer kind of stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Or just, even what I'm talking about with Poor David's is there are several people who, tell a whole narrative throughout a song, and I've judged their songwriting competitions before, and often it's like, who can tell the saddest story? And the judges at the end are all impressed with, whoever just gutted everyone the most.
Right.
Mm. But it can also be just really atmospheric music without lyrics. I think just whatever matches your particular mood.
To me, it's music about loneliness. To me, a sad song, ultimately, whether it's Slayer that we just heard or something else, it gets to that feeling of loneliness.
Well, I was thinking of, if I may interject a classical example.
Please,
please do. Please lift the conversation.
Schubert's song cycle, Die Winterreise, The Winter mm-hmm. Journey, it's about losing love and being alone, and at the end, the dogs are barking at this forlorn guy, and then you hear a guy playing a hurdy-gurdy, and here's the guy alone in this winter environment with the hurdy-gurdy, and all along there have been these, the texts are about wintry things, and that last song, if you've got a great singer and pianist, it's just devastating.
So we're actually going to smoothly segue from Schubert to Miley Cyrus.
That makes me sad.
Do not try that at home.
Because the connection is so clear. It's another chapter in Every Song Ever about audio space, in which he actually calls getting clear. It's not about Scientology. It is about the idea of audio space, which is a fairly abstract idea, and he's really into
Please explain.
The Miley Cyrus song, Party in the USA. I'm actually going to read what he says first, and then we can listen to a little bit of it. I'm listening to Party in the USA by Miley Cyrus. It is a song about listening, one of the greatest ever made. It begins with chunked rhythm guitar and moves along with medium tempo, funk drums, tambourine, and the most amazing synthetic swell in the chorus, distended, overmodulated, bass-thickened bloop glissandi that seem to bulge out of the wall, preceded by hissing and shooshing, pushing against your ear. That's Miley Cyrus.
I thought all those things
here.
When I listened to that song.
So let's give a little listen to Party in the USA. So Ben Ratliff is nothing if not democratic. Explaining a little bit more, the producer, Dr. Luke's signature is compression, which means a narrowing of the dynamic range of an audio signal such that the soft sounds and the loud sounds are both loud.
Oh, I think this is brilliant because that song is immensely likable, but I would never have been able to explain why that is.
It's not sad.
Yeah.
At all.
No. No, in fact, it's the song you turn on when you want to feel happy.
Yes. Good times.
Kind of defiantly happy, too.
Scott, audio space, any thoughts on how that applies in the real music world?
I'm not sure what it means by audio space.
Let me read a little bit more from the very beginning. Beyond the fact of the physical dimensions, it's talking about a particular song, the drums are mixed high in the recording, especially on the snare and bass drum. You hear a fair amount of reverb. Again, this is some really abstract concept stuff that he's applying to specific songs. What does he mean exactly?
I'm ashamed to admit I love that song. I'm trying to decide if I can feel a little more smug about that or ashamed.
I feel like space is the wrong, it's the right word, but it's a reassignation of that word because space implies a physical element and there's nothing really physical about.
Yeah, I think he's talking about more
mental,
oral space.
Yeah.
Headspace.
I thought of like The Weeknd or Kanye West or some artists now who are making this very like atmospheric music that has crisp beats but they create sort of a vibe. It doesn't pack your ears with all these sounds. They try to just sort of establish a vibe and ride that beat, ride that sort of. But that's what I think of when I think of space or sonic space. Yeah. But it's a little different than the
like
way you described it.
You step into the song. You know, like when you go and you see a band like that, you feel as though you've entered a new dimension. Or,
sure. Yeah.
It's interesting because there's another chapter on closeness and density, mm-hmm. which I guess he's kind of positing as the opposite of space.
What are some examples of that?
Fats Waller, Ain't Misbehavin'. Lil Wayne, Mrs. Officer. Nina Simone, Mississippi Goddamn. These are just, you know, examples. Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. Oklahoma Hills and Keep Knocking, But You Can't Come In.
Can I force
Ben
a detour
Ratliff.
For a moment?
Please.
Since we have two music writers in the room. How do you deal with taking the sonic experience and turning it into words? I mean, this is what I think we're talking about, is how you apply language.
Yeah, it's what Elvis Costello once said was like dancing about architecture.
Yeah.
Which was sort of borrowing an idea from Goethe, but never mind.
Well, there you go. Elvis, Goethe, you know.
I mean, it seems to be the hardest challenge of all of the forms of criticism.
Well, I don't know whether it's worse than dance. I have tried writing about dance and decided I was completely incompetent at it. But yeah, that's the challenge, to describe a performance in a way. And I'm never so happy that when someone says, I read your review and I could just imagine what it sounded like. Mm. And particularly with a new work, you're trying to describe what the experience is like. And sometimes I think I can do it and other times I can't. But it is a very ineffable phenomenon, and it happens in time and it goes away. And how do you sort of grab it out of space and preserve it?
Well, and it seems that language is mostly built around things that we've pointed at and assigned words for, right? And so then now you're trying to describe something that's all.
It seems like, I mean, for those of us who are less trained in music than Scott, I mean, a lot of it seems like it's about trying to make the abstract literal somehow, trying to make the abstract concrete, which is hard. For the various things that I write about, music is easily the hardest for me.
Yeah.
Right, I'm nowhere near the level of Ratliff as far as understanding the construct of music, but I just try to think about it from the experience of listening to it and how you feel, what you notice first, and what becomes bothersome, I think.
And then figuring out what that is and how to explain that.
Sure.
So we are going to close with one last example. This is what he calls, what Ben Ratliff calls, Stubbornness and the Single Note, a chapter called Church Bell Tone. And he's just talking about how using the same note he actually has a different chapter on repetition, but this is a little more specific thing. He talks about Drake in Furthest Thing. He talks about Neil Young's guitar solo in Cinnamon Girl, which I was going to choose, but you can't stream Neil Young. So, sorry, Neil.
Oh,
tough
luck. I didn't realize that.
But he also talks about the guitar solo in the Ramones' I Want to Be Sedated. As he writes, Johnny Ramone's guitar solo in the Ramones' I Want to Be Sedated, only eighth notes, a pretty good imitation of the states of non-thinking and non-feeling. So a little, you know, it's kind of the Ramones, a little 2-3 minute just jams, just, you know, get your energy out in a slightly more festive way than Slayer, perhaps, a slightly less sad way.
And exactly three chords.
And exactly, yeah, exactly.
It may be blasphemy to say this, but that may translate these days to like what EDM does for people. I think they're just waiting for that drop.
Yeah.
They're waiting for the mood.
Yeah.
And they're not necessarily concerned with the musician behind those sounds. It's all about how they feel and what their experience is.
So that is Every Song Ever, 20 Ways to Listen in an Age of Musical Plenty by Ben Ratliff. You'll find links to some of the things we've talked about today on our show page at guidelive.com/podcasts. Drop us an email at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com. Hello, Miley. Or send us a tweet at mixedmediapod. Please subscribe to our show on iTunes. Leave us a review, as long as it's a good one. Just search for our name. Mixed Media is engineered by Tommy Noel and produced by Christopher Wynn and Chris Wagner. For Christopher Wynn, Lauren Smart, Hunter Hawk, and Scott Cantrell, I am Chris Wagner. We thank you for joining us.
Get to the club in my taxi cab. Everybody's looking at me now. Like,